Rusty and I weren't here last week. Did anybody take down the prayer list from last Sunday? Okay. All right. I want to begin by asking, did all of you go to the worship service today? And did you have you had a chance to hear Travis's sermon? Okay, for the help of the Nagels, then, what was the focus of the service? What was the focus of the sermon?
Pride.
And if you were to try to summarize in a phrase or a sentence what Travis said, what would it be? Think accurately and appropriately about yourself. Not too high, not too low, but think right. Okay. I want to tell you that every year about this time for some 20-something years, a group of crazy people at Harvard have gathered in a big auditorium and have announced what are called the Ig Nobel Prizes. The Ig Nobel Prizes as opposed to the Nobel Prizes. What they do is they look across the spectrum of all the research that's been done in the world for the last year, and they pick out the ones that seem to be the craziest. One of their awards was jointly split. This particular research project won both the biology award and the psychology award this year. The title of the study was Reverse Beer Goggles. Now, to understand the study, it helps to be somewhat aware of country music. There's an old song that says, the women start looking better around closing time. Meaning that if you are looking through beer goggles, that everybody looks more attractive. And the study was studying, is that reversed? Do you think you look better at the end of something like that? And they found two things, they said. Number one, they found that yes, indeed, you do think you look better after a little while being with another group. But it turns out it doesn't matter whether you drink or not. And the phrase that they used, I heard about this on public radio, I've gone and read a little bit about it. The phrase they use is, nearly everybody in group settings tends to think of themselves as more attractive, more clever, more whatever than they really are. And isn't that interesting? I thought you might just like to lay that aside right along the edge of what you heard this morning, because I think that is a factor of sorts. Now, last time I was here, we were working in 1 Kings. We had finished 1 Kings chapter 3. And so this morning I want to start with 1 Kings chapter 4. And I want to begin with a little bit of orientation. 1 Kings chapter 4 through chapter 10 focuses more or less on the splendor and majesty of Solomon's kingdom, on the splendor and majesty of Solomon as king, on his wealth and on his riches. It focuses as much on that as it does on his wisdom, which you would think would have been the focus. Chapter 11 is a bridge, and at the end of chapter 11, Solomon dies, and chapter 12 starts out something new. So, essentially, our next task is to take a close look at Solomon. The first three chapters of this and the last little bit of 2 Samuel was the transition from David to Solomon. Solomon is now secure as king. And so, from chapter 4 through chapter 10, you're seeing some of that splendor. So, starting in chapter 4, the first thing you see is a list of Solomon's officials. From chapter 4, verse 1 through chapter 6, you see the people who were the priests, the secretaries, the herald, the commander of the army, more priests, chief administrators. I love the title Friend of the King that comes in the middle of verse 5. Master of the palace. Notice the last person in this list, the tail end of chapter 4, verse 6. Who's this person? Mine says Adoram. Does yours have it spelled that way? And what was his function? He was in charge of all forced labor. Now, in the first hour we worked through this. Forced labor sounds like slavery, and it's not quite. So let me try to help you understand the difference. I had occasion to go back and look at, you don't need to know why, I looked at the laws of Tennessee controlling road construction from the late 1800s, before automobiles came in, before highways were built. The laws of Tennessee required every able-bodied man, women I think were excluded from this, to spend a certain number of hours per year working on maintaining the roads. If you had a major road in front of your house, that's where you worked. And if you didn't, then they would assign you, and you had to put in a certain amount of work every year to do that. That was forced labor in the sense that this was. It's not exactly slavery, although if you didn't do it, you would get into big problems. Nowadays, we pay taxes, and then somebody else goes out and doesn't build the roads very well. But in those days, we could not build the roads very well ourselves in this sort of forced labor. Okay? So, chapter 4, verse 7, mine says he had 12 administrators for the different regions of the country. Now pause and just think about this for a minute. Susan, you're off the hook, but everybody else, you're supposed to have already read this. So if you think about 12 administrators for the whole of the country, you would think this would be like governors of a province, right? So that you'd think that would be what it would be, but it's not. Verse 7, what was their job, these 12 administrators? They were the ones who saw to it that the king had his provisions. Each one was responsible for one area in the country, and from that area they would pull out food, livestock, other kinds of things, and deliver it to the king for 1 month. So each one was responsible for 1 month. And you got a list of these things. Now, in my translation, the people who did this translation have tried to reorder some verses in chapter 4 and chapter 5 so that it reads a little bit more logically. So I have a little bit of trouble knowing which verse you're looking at in your system. But I think where I want to take you is verse 27 in chapter 4. These administrators provided food for Solomon and for all those who were admitted by him to the royal table, each for a period of a month. Is that what yours says? Okay, so that's sort of repeating what verse 7 said. They ensured that nothing was wanting. They also provided barley and straw for the horses and the draft animals where required, each according to the quota demanded them. Back up to verse 22, and it specifies what they actually had to get. My translation has reordered this, so it says, they're bringing the provisions now. Here are the provisions they had to bring in. The daily provisions for Solomon, daily provisions, were what? Mine says 30 measures, that might be barrels of flour, 60 measures of meal, 10 fattened oxen, 20 free grazing oxen. How many sheep? 100. And this doesn't count the deer, the gazelle, the roebucks, or the fattened poultry. Okay? You start to see the picture? That's a lot of food to pull away from the people. And yet, if I take a look at verse 25 and verse 20, you've got to put verse 20 and 25 together. Verse 20, Judah and Israel lived in security, mine says. What does yours say at that point? That should be verse 25. Safety, yours says. Everyone under his vine and fig tree, all the way from Dan, that's way in the north, to Beersheba, that's way in the south, or otherwise, throughout the lifetime of Solomon. Go back to verse 20, I think it is. Judah and Israel were, mine says, numerous. Does yours have that? As numerous as the sand on the seashore. They all, it says three things. What's the first thing? They were all ate, they drank, and they were happy. Okay? Fat and sassy, you might say. So far, okay? Okay. How in verse 20 and 25 were the people described? How were they identified? No, not what it says about them. I just want to who were they? Yeah, but that's what it says about them. I want to know, what does it say? Who are we talking about? The people of Judah and Israel. What's that? That's the division between the north and south that's coming, that actually was already largely there. Again, we don't realize that, but that's the division that was there. Doing okay? Okay. Still in chapter 4, I think, but I'm not sure. Verse 29, does that say God gave Solomon wisdom? Is that what that is? Mine says he gave Solomon immense wisdom and understanding. And a heart, how does it describe it?
Largeness,
your says. Mine says as vast as the sand on the seashore. It's interesting. It describes the people as numerous as the sand on the seashore, and his heart big enough to encompass all of them. Verse 30, you sort of get the feeling that the guy who's writing this, the historians who are putting this together, have their thumbs under their lapels, and they got a little bit of pride coming out. The wisdom of Solomon surpassed the wisdom of who? All the sons of the east, that would be Persia. All the wisdom of Egypt, that would be one direction, another direction. He was wiser than anyone else, and especially, and it names four or five people. He's wiser than this one, wiser than that. Now, what evidence do the historians give you to believe that assertion? Verse 32, what does it say he did? He composed, mine says, spoke, yours says, 3,000 Proverbs. We have the book of Proverbs. Some of his are in there. What else?
And his songs numbered 1,005.
So he was composing songs. Now, when you compose songs, it comes in two parts. What are the two parts? The music and the lyrics, right? We don't know whether he's doing both or doing some part or going back and forth. Verse 33. Mine starts out, he could discourse on. And it starts to name some stuff. You come down to the middle of that verse, he could discourse on, and some more things come. What does yours say at that point? And mine says he could discourse on. This is verse 33, I think. What does yours say? He could speak on. He could yak away about this and that. And he could do so with intelligence and with insight. Is that wisdom?
Knowledge.
It sounds more like knowledge if you make a distinction between knowledge and wisdom, which I think the Bible does. But if he's seeing things in the knowledge base that other people have had access to and haven't noticed yet, then there's a wisdom involved in that ability. What does it say he could discourse on? Botany? Ecology? Herpetology, is that the one that has reptiles? Ichthyology, is that fish? Right? Biology of all kinds, he could discourse on that. And it only lists that, not to say there's not other things. And then verse 34 concludes this. What is verse 34? People came from where? All over the world. Why? To hear his wisdom. Do you think that phrase captures it? What do you think people would come for? I want to bring problems to you and let you sort of give me some help with those. Or I want to bring challenges to you and see how you stand up to that. Or they may bring to them other kinds of issues. We're dealing with this thing. How do we work with that? And what does it say those people also brought? Gifts from the kings of the world. And if you read that together, you get the impression that probably what was happening was that people in powerful positions were sending representatives to try to get Solomon to help them with this or that problem they might be facing. And they would bring presents from those people as an offering to him for the time that he gave them. Okay? What have you seen so far? This guy has all the creature comforts that man could ever want. Food is just overflowing. And gifts are coming in from all over the world as people come. And he's got a rich intellectual life. Now, pause for just a minute. You jump over to the book of Ecclesiastes, which we believe was written by Solomon. One of the things he says was, I tried to find something that would fulfill me. I tried eating and drinking. I tried intellectual discourse. I tried building projects, and we're about to hit the building projects. What you're seeing in here is a recounting sort of on the ground at the time of the kind of things that he then reflects on as he's writing Ecclesiastes. So I don't want to go to Ecclesiastes yet, but I do want to make the connection between those two. Okay, anything so far? I don't know that we found anything of great spiritual insight yet, but here we go. All right? Chapter 5, verse 1. Chapter 5, verse 1. Who steps onto the scene?
Hiram.
And Hiram is king of Tyre. Now this turns out to be something very misleading, and I forgot to say anything in the first hour about this. Tyre is the capital city, but the country has a name too. And you and I know the country name better than we know Tyre as a name. Do you know the country where this was? If you look at the shore of the Mediterranean, if you look at the shore of the Mediterranean, sort of like that, with Egypt down here. Okay. There's a country that's sort of here, there's a country that's sort of here. The Jordan River is sort of here, and Israel is sort of there. Moab is down in here. Ammon is maybe over here someplace. You'll hear some more about those later. Remember this country? When we took a cruise and went into this area, we stopped at Ashdod, which was the coastal city here. Ashdod is an ancient name. It was one of the capital cities of Philistia. These were the Philistines down here. Tyre is up in here. And Tyre was the capital of Phoenicia. What are the Phoenicians known for? Please tell me, some of you know.
Sailors.
A little bit later, you're going to find one of the things that Solomon did was he decided he wasn't getting enough gold and stuff from nearby. He outfitted some ships. And it was Hiram's people that began were the sailors on those ships. Hiram helped him build them and sort of went into trade with them. Now, Hiram sent messengers to him because he had heard that David had died and Solomon had taken over as king. Solomon sent a message back. And I want you to watch how he says this. I believe I'm at chapter 5, verse 2. I think that's where we are. You are aware that my father David was unable to build a temple for the name of the Lord his God on account of the wars waged on him from every side until the Lord put his enemies under the soles of his feet. But now the Lord my God has given me peace. I believe this is verse 4. On every side, not one enemy, no calamities. I propose then to build a temple for the name of the Lord my God, in accordance with what the Lord told my father David when he said, quote, your son whom I shall place on your throne to succeed you, he will be the man to build a temple for my name, end of quote. This is the message he sent. Is that more or less following along with what you've got? Okay. What was the purpose of the temple? What was the purpose of the temple?
Was it the first physical building?
Well, they've had a tent before.
And altars along the way, but they didn't have
And the altars were outside.
Right.
But what was the purpose of the temple? It was going to be
a house in which God could live.
Yeah.
Right?
Wrong. Read the three things you just saw. Because that's...
Gene, thank you. That's what I needed.
That's what most everybody is going to think. Solomon is going to treat this, and I think one signal of his wisdom is he's figured this out. What's the purpose of the temple? Verse 2, you are aware that my father David was unable to build a temple for the name of the Lord his God. Verse 5, I propose then to build a temple for the name of the Lord my God, in accordance with what the Lord told my father David, quote, your son whom I shall place on your throne to succeed you, he will be the man to build a temple for my name. There is a subtle but vital difference between those two things. And Scripture is saying it clearly. I mentioned that this isn't the first time you've seen it, and one of the folks in the first hour came up and told me, you don't have to go here, but if you go to 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 13, God is saying to David, he, Solomon, is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Remember that place about the covenant? Building a temple not as the house that God will live in, but as a place God can put his name. There's a difference between those two. And whatever that difference is, Solomon's got it. And in his words, he's trying to bring your attention to it. The historian giving you those words. Okay, so far? All right. Verse 6. Now he comes to the point. He's writing, Solomon's writing back to Hiram. And he says to Hiram, I want to have a trade deal with you. What's he asking Hiram to send him? Not just wood, specific wood. What kind of wood? Cedar. If you're going to have wood for building buildings with, what's the best wood to have? Cedar. Brick and stone are even better. For example, woodpeckers can't peck a hole through a brick. They break their little beaks. They can peck a hole through cedar. I know. I wanted brick on my house. I ended up getting everything I wanted except the house is made of cedar. Great. Except now I got holes in it. You know how you patch a hole? I came from East Tennessee. I pick up an old license plate. Hammer that in. Actually, my wife and my son do. Come see it sometime.
It's not there anymore.
Yeah, but it'll be back up pretty soon. Those little birds are still out there. Well, we did this with a black piece of metal, but they had forgotten this, and I came home, and here's two license plates hammered onto the wall. I said, I'm home, I'm home. Okay, what is Solomon going to send Hiram to complete the trade?
Wages.
Pay wages.
Verse 10 and verse 11. So Hiram provided Solomon with all the cedar wood and juniper he wanted, while Solomon gave Hiram 20,000 kor, whatever a kor is. A kor, they say, is something like 2 bushels of wheat, and a whole number of gallons or barrels of olive oil. And he gave this to Hiram every year. What's he doing? All those provinces that were being swept up for food for Solomon's table, he's now sweeping them again to get some food to send up to Hiram. So there's a trade, food for wood. Come to verse 13. What else does Solomon do? Judy? I'm only calling on you because it's that same topic again.
That's right.
Mine says he raised a levy throughout Israel for forced labor. What was the levy? 30,000 men. What are these 30,000 men supposed to do? 10,000 every month go up to Lebanon or Phoenicia. Actually, Phoenicia is on the coast, and Lebanon, I think, goes up from there. And so the forests are over in here, but Phoenicia controls them. They're going to go up there, 10,000 of them, they work for a month. And then they have, what does it say? Mine says they have 2 months off.
At home.
Yeah, 2 months at home. What do they do at home? They do the other work that didn't get done while they were off doing the king's work. 10,000 every month, 1 month out of every three. Who was in charge of the forced labor? Same guy we saw back at the early part of chapter 4. What else did Solomon have? I'm now at verse 15.
Transporters.
I heard mine says porters, and somebody else said people who lift and carry things. How many?
70,000.
How many?
70,000.
And it says people who worked in the quarries in the mountains cutting out the stone. How many were those?
80,000.
And then on top of that are all the administrators who stand around and tell everybody what to do.
Project managers.
At the king's orders, they quarried huge stones, special stones for the laying of the temple foundations, dress stones. I remember a writer some years ago who said, we have a tendency to think the technology of today is superior to the technology of old. And he said, if you think that, I'm going to show you a rock, a stone, cut stone, 77 tons, sitting here 6 miles from where it was quarried, and we know it was quarried there because we matched up the surfaces. Put it back.
We don't have to build it.
Just put it back. Nobody knows how to put it back. We don't know how they got it. moved 6-8 miles away. In some cases, it's a lot further than that. One of the folks in the first hour had a chance to go to Delphi in Greece, 3,500 feet up a mountain, and they've got giant stones up there that have been sitting there for thousands of years, and they haven't moved. They still have the same tolerances that they used to have way back when. We couldn't do that today. We don't know how. And if you start to read this and then go to some of these places where the really old stuff is, 2,000, 3,000 years old, it will take on a different meaning. We've had the chance to go to the Parthenon. We've had a chance to see the Colosseum. That's projects on this kind of scale. How did they do it? Well, one way they did it was they had 80,000 people at work.
Well, okay. I think the building the cathedral in Washington, what did it take, 40 years?
49 years, yeah.
To build that cathedral in Washington?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Of course it's a lot larger than this, but...
Verse 18, Solomon's workers and Hiram's workers and the Giblites. I don't know who the Giblites are. He just drops them in there. There's a footnote I could read if I felt like it. Cut and assembled the wood and the stone for the building of the temple. Okay, we're finished with chapters 4 and 5. We look at chapter 6. Chapter 6, they start to build the temple. When did they start to build the temple? Chapter 6, verse 1. 480 years after the Exodus. Verse 2. How big was the temple?
60 cubits long.
Cubit is 18 inches. That's about a foot and a half. Can you multiply 60 by 1.5? 90 feet. 60 cubits long. That's 90 feet. How wide? 20 cubits. Multiply that by 1.5. 30. 90 by 30. And how tall? 45. Yeah. 30 cubits, I think it says, and therefore it's 45 feet. Okay. In the first hour, a fellow sitting over here says, a basketball court's about 90 feet long. Well, different basketball courts are different lengths. I played a little bit of basketball. I was never big enough and tall enough to play basketball when I was in high school, but I played a little later. Some courts are long, some courts are short, but 90 feet apparently is a typical thing like that. So how big was this temple? Not all that big. Not all that big, except there were all kinds of courtyards and porticos and plazas and other things that were around it. So all the things that were there did take up pretty big space. But the temple itself was how long? How wide? How tall? 90 feet long, 30 feet wide, 45 feet high. So far okay? Okay, now my very next sentence, verse 9, begins to talk about some of these plazas and other things. It says a portico. It may say a porch on yours. What's the difference between a plaza and a porch? A porch got a roof. Okay, it's a covered. It's open but covered. That's what it. The portico in front of the hekel of the temple was 20 cubits long across the width of the temple. Well, that's the width of the temple. The temple was 20 cubits, 30 feet wide. So it's 30 feet wide and 10 cubits wide along the length of the temple. How's that hekel? H-E-K-E-L. What does yours say at that spot?
The front of the temple.
Yours says the front. Yours says the nave. Some translations say the main hall, and that's a pretty good name.
Yeah, the front.
Mine
says the foyer.
The foyer.
At the front of the temple.
Oh, yes, but that's the first word, right? Yeah, the portico corresponds to the foyer. Just after that, it says the portico in front of the hekel of the temple. I'm looking for that second term. Some translations will say main hall.
Sanctuary.
Yours says sanctuary. Some of them say sanctuary. Some say main hall. Okay? So how big was the main hall? 90 feet by 30 feet? No. It was 60 by 30. The main hall was 60 by 30. What does that leave?
30
by 30.
I thought the porch was incremental.
Porch is outside the whole thing. Mine says the portico in front of the Hekel of the temple, and the word Hekel means the main hall of the temple. A little bit later, it says, verse 4, he made windows for the temple with frames and lattice work. He also built an annex against the temple wall right around the Hekel and the Debir. Now that's where I need. I need to know what those words are right at the end of verse 5. Mine says Hekel and Debir, and later on you have to really work to figure out what those are. Hekel is the main hall. How big is the main hall? 60 by 30. And the Debir is behind it, which is 30 by 30. What does yours have at the end of verse 5? Yours says the inner sanctuary. Okay, my translation says Debir, and I think that's a transliteration of the Hebrew that's here. Okay, does anybody have anything other than inner sanctuary for that last piece? What does it have just before it says inner sanctuary? What's that other term?
Main hall.
So yours says main hall at that spot. Okay, yours says main hall and then inner?
Main hall.
It says nave and then inner sanctuary.
Mine is all the way around the sides and rear of the building.
It just says the building. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't break it up into these two parts. Okay? All right. If you come down to verse 15, it starts to talk about all the things he was doing with all the wood that he had. He lined the inside of the temple walls with panels of cedar wood, paneling them on the inside from the floor of the temple to the beams of the ceiling, laid the floor of the temple with juniper planks. 16. The 20 cubits measured from the end of the temple he built of cedar planks. And this part was reserved as the Debir, comma, and it has another phrase. I believe that was verse 16. What does yours say? The most holy place. Mine says the Holy of Holies. Whatever yours says right there, Holy of Holies is the term most of us have learned if we've been in church for a while. Okay? And it says, the temple measured 40 cubits, that's the Hekel, in front of the Debir, blah, blah, blah. And then verse 20, it says, the size of the Debir, the Holy of Holies. What was the size of the Holy of Holies?
20
wide, about 20 long. About 20 high, or 30 feet by 30 feet by 30 feet. What geometrical object is made by 30 by 30 by 30? That's a cube. There are a number of things in Scripture that are described with dimensions. I have found a grand total of 2 that are cubic. This is one. This is one. The Holy of Holies is the only thing in the Old Testament that is specifically identified as cubic. All the others, as you just saw, were rectangular. Okay? Do you know what the other thing is in Scripture that's cubic? Revelation 21, when it describes the new city, when it describes the new Jerusalem coming down from heaven, from heavens, basically what you and I would call heaven, what's its size? 1,500 miles wide, 1,500 miles deep, and 1,500 miles high. The only two objects in the whole of the Bible that are described with dimensions, as far as I know, the only two where the dimensions come out to describe a cube are the Holy of Holies and heaven. What's true of the Holy of Holies? This is the place where God is going to put his name. What's true of heaven? This is where God is going to put himself. Where? In the middle of his people. I don't think that's an accident. But I also think it's something most of us wouldn't recognize as we go through here. Doing okay so far? If you start at verse 21, he overlays every piece of wood in that part of the building with gold. You have a roof that's 45 feet tall. I have a picture of a roof inside of a roof, the ceiling of this Holy of Holies that encases it, that's a little bit lower than that. Starting in verse 23 and going on, he begins to talk about carvings that are put in the room. carvings of two great winged creatures. In some translations, they're called cherubim, pictures of things that Moses apparently saw when he was on the mountain with God way, way back when God was talking about the building of the tabernacle. He talks about carving figures in verse 29 of winged creatures and palm trees and rosettes inside and outside this space. And he talks about covering everything with gold. This must have been splendid and beautiful.
It doesn't really talk in this particular section that he was consulting with God on all of his directions. Is that given elsewhere?
Well, I have the picture. Let's back up and see what we've seen before. What has Solomon done to get ready for building the temple? He's got stone, dressed stone coming. He's got wood coming. But what's he doing with all those things? He's following the blueprints, so to speak, that David put down. David put down the plans. David began to gather all these materials to do things with. Solomon is now adding specifically to it dressed, huge pieces of dressed stone and the cypress wood or the juniper wood coming from Tyre or from Lebanon through Tyre. And I think the plans are already set. And I think he's got workmen who are working to the plans that David gave him. That's the picture I have anyway. You have a different picture.
What's the distinction between an idol and this glorious, wonderful
painting
he's building with all the gold?
I was sort of hoping nobody would ask that. I don't know exactly how to answer it, except nobody's worshiping the winged creature.
Right.
These carvings that are there to enhance the beauty and the brilliance of the place, not to be objects of worship themselves. And that's all I can tell you. But the word idol means something that is worshipped in place of worshiping God, as opposed to something that's in place to help you worship God. And I sense them making that distinction.
Was the Ark of the Covenant kept in the Holy of Holies?
Not yet.
But will it be?
Chapter 8. Okay, little message, we're not going to get to chapter 8 today.
Over.
We're going to stop just short of that. So that gives you time to read ahead in chapter 8.
To do the homework we should have done last week.
Yeah. Okay. But it is absolutely the place that the Ark of the Covenant is going to go. And once it goes there, that's then a permanent place. It stays there. Chapter 6, verse 37 tells you what? It tells you when the foundations of the temple were laid. And then verse 38 tells you when the temple was finished. When was the temple finished? Tail end of verse 38. 7 years it took to build the temple. Except Judy has seen it. Except what? It took 4 years to build the foundations. So, when you ask the question, how long did it take to build the temple? The answer is 7 years. Right there it is at the tail end of verse 38. But if you look more closely, it says 4 years in, they had finished the foundations. Now, 7 years after that, 11 years total. So the question, how long did it take to build the temple? The answer to that is 7 years. But if you include how long did it take to build the foundations and the temple, it gets up to more like 11. Now, in my translation, almost immediately in chapter 7, verse 1, it digresses to tell you what else he built. What else did Solomon build? What else did Solomon build? Excuse me. He built
his palace.
His palace. Okay. Verse 2. What did he build? Chapter 7, verse 2. What did he build? House of the forest or the house of the pillars of Lebanon.
Is that different from the palace or
well,
the same?
When you start reading through here, it is my belief that verse 1 should have a colon at the end of it. He is building a palace. As he built the palace, here's what he built. He built this and this and this and this and this and this and this, and they all constitute the palace.
Okay.
Most people think this is set to the south of where the temple was going to be built. So I think it was the palace contained the House of the Forest of Lebanon. This would be sort of an entry place, a spectacular place. You come to see the king, you walk through this area to get there. Verse 6, it's called the Colonnade in my translation. Do you see that? Hall of Pillars, your says. Okay. Verse 7. Hall of Justice. It's also in my translation called first the Hall of the Throne, and yours may say the Throne Room. Verse 8. His own living quarters are built. Tail end of verse 8. And there was a house similar to this built for Pharaoh's daughter. And then verse 9, it starts to tell about all the things that were built. So at the very least, you have the palace consisted of this big hall, whatever the Hall of the Forest of Lebanon means. It has the colonnade or the pillars, the Hall of Pillars. It has the Hall of Justice, which has the throne in it, and the throne itself. All these things are described. They're described in great detail. I don't know anything to pull out of that except it is splendid at a level that splendidness has never reached. It is glorious at a level that gloriousness has never reached, but it all pales in significance to how that Holy of Holies was being built. That's what I want you to see. Okay, so far? Now, verse 13 of chapter 7 is troubling. Verse 13 of chapter 7 is troubling. King Solomon sent for someone. Who did he send for?
Your own.
Mine says Hiram of Tyre. Mm-hmm. Now, who had he negotiated with?
Tyre.
Hiram of Tyre. So some translations call this person Huram,
yes,
to make the point it's not the same person. He's not bringing the king down for this. This is somebody else. So if yours says Hiram, it ain't the same Hiram. If yours says Huram, it may be. Let's just spell it differently so that you'll know it, to not to think it's the same person. What does it tell you about this person? Still in verse, actually now in verse 14. Says he was part Jewish, half Jewish. His mother, I think it was, was a person from Naphtali, the tribe of Naphtali. So mom was Jewish and daddy was from Tyre. And what does it tell you about him? Okay. Mine says his father had been a Tyrian, comma, a bronze worker. It sounds like daddy had been a bronze worker and so was Sonny Boy. At least that's the way I read this. Mm-hmm. Solomon sent for this guy. How did Solomon know to send for this guy?
Must
have been famous.
Yeah.
Must have been famous, right? What does Solomon want him for? He's going to have a lot of bronze work to do. And the bronze work consists of chapter 15. What's the first thing?
Two bronze pillars.
Okay? Those are not pillows, they are pillars. Okay? Verse 21, where were the pillars erected? In front of that portico that it talked about a while back that stuck out off the front of the temple.
These are huge.
What are they called? They're so big they've got names.
Boaz and Jacob.
Should be Boaz and Ruth, but that's not what they did. What do they call them? Yachin or Yachin and Boaz. Nobody knows for sure what the words mean, but the commentators say their best guess is it means the it is firm, it is strong. Just two of these giant things. Now they built a bunch more somewhat smaller things. But there's one more big thing they built. Verse 23, what did they make? In my translation, it gives the name that they gave it. They called it the sea. Mine says it was of cast metal. How far from rim to rim? That's the diameter of the circle.
10 cubits.
How far around the circle? 30 cubits. So 10 across, 30 around. What's the value of pi?
3.
3.
According to this.
According to this. And people who don't like the Bible will say, there's a reason not to believe in the Bible. They don't know the value of pi. I don't explain things. but I do notice them. The value of pi is implicit in there, and it didn't come out to 3.1416 and then change after that. Okay. Maybe this was an approximate value. How thick, verse 26, how thick was this bowl?
4 inches.
And breadth.
The breadth of a hand in thickness. Breadth of a hand about 4 inches, right? Okay. Its rim was shaped like the rim of a cup, lily shaped. What did it rest on? It was made completely out of bronze. What did it rest on?
12
bronze bulls. 3 facing this way, 3 that way. 3 this way, 3 north, south, east, west. 3 of them facing each way. This big thing sitting in the middle of it. What was its purpose? Answer, we don't know.
It says it held 2,000 baths.
Yeah, mine says measure. 10,000. Measure. Well, you sort of have the picture of baptism in the biggest baptismal pool you've ever seen. 7.5 feet deep, I think they said, somewhere in there.
It talks about wheels.
No, that's on the next thing. They got water carts that move things back and forth. They've got lampstands that are built. They got all kinds of stuff that are in here. All these cast up. This is what Huram or the other Hiram of Tyre is doing all this brass work. By the time you get finished, which is verse 40, he's also made containers for the ash that comes off the altars when the burnt sacrifices are finished, and there's ash from the woods and ash from whatever, scoops and sprinkling bowls and all that kind of stuff. Talks about all the things he made. Verse 41, the 2 pillars. Verse 42, verse 43, verse 44, the 1 sea, the 12 oxen. It goes on. And then it says in verse 48, Solomon made all the objects designed for the temple of the Lord, the golden altar, the golden table, the lampstands, and all this kind of stuff. Did you notice the sentence that started verse 48? Hiram made all this other stuff. Who's making this? Solomon. Was Solomon working in gold himself, or was he then overseeing? That's not clear. In Ecclesiastes, it talks about being intimately involved in building projects. And I got to tell you, if you're somebody who's a general contractor and you don't know how to do what the people below you are supposed to do, you're not going to be very good. The best general contractor can do any job on the whole work.
A note on this one says Solomon chose only the best.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
There's no way Solomon could do floral work and have it be anything to glorify God.
Don't know. Don't know. Verse 51, all the work done by King Solomon for the temple of the Lord was completed. And then Solomon, in addition, it appears, brought in gifts which his father David had consecrated. Silver and gold and all those kinds of things. Let me see if I can find the place.
One of the things that's in the footnote that I have, when we were talking about all the carvings and the gloriousness and the splendor of it, said that they were done not for their beauty, but because they were symbols that God had assured Israel that he was in their midst as he brought them out of
Egypt.
Through Egypt and assured them that he was in their presence.
480 years before, right, they had to have.
I am suggesting that verse 48 of chapter 7, that verse 14 of chapter 6 suggests that Solomon wasn't just overseeing the work, but that he was part of the work. I don't know how far to push that thought, but it does have that sense to it. Okay? Now, verse 1 of chapter 8 says what?
Then King Solomon summoned into his presence at Jerusalem the elders of Israel, all the heads of the tribes and the chiefs of the Israelite families, to bring up the Ark of the Lord's Covenant from Zion, the city of David.
That's where we're going to stop. So you want to find out anything more, you got to come back next week. Or read it on your own. You can probably pick out most of what you need to see. What's happening now is everything is finished and ready. Now they're going to bring the ark in. So that's the next stage. Let me give you something to think about. I didn't have quite time enough to do this in the first hour, so you're getting something they didn't get. Where's the ark coming from?
I was thinking it was a tent.
From a tent, yes. Where's the tent?
Ziklag?
No, they brought it to Jerusalem. Remember David was dancing and all that kind of stuff? It was being brought to Jerusalem. Where's it coming from? It says, bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord up from Zion, the city of David. Now we got two problems here. Bethlehem was called the city of David, but that's because that's his birthplace. Jerusalem was called the city of David because that's where he put his capital. So far, okay? It's that second meaning that's in front of you. But I thought the tent was already in Jerusalem. They're saying bring it from the city of David up to where the temple has been built. What does that mean? It's built on a hill inside the city of Jerusalem. Or was. Inside the city of Jerusalem. Except, maybe it wasn't inside the city of Jerusalem yet. So my challenge to you is see if you can figure out what's going on. We'll talk about this next time. This is as much as we'll do for today. I will tell you that the big significance comes next week. As you get into chapter 8, as you get into chapter 9, as you get into chapter 10, that's when some of the big significance comes in. We're setting a groundwork for that now. And next week you'll see those things come out. All right, let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, you told us in the New Testament that all these things that happened in the Old Testament happened as examples for us and for us to learn from them. We're learning all kinds of things from Solomon. We're learning that sometimes you entrust a human being with insight and wisdom and how to figure things out far beyond what you normally would. But we realize that that comes with a great, great sense of burden of responsibility to use that insight and to use that wisdom. And we want to learn from Solomon what happens when things go right and what happens when things don't go right. We pray today that you would give us insight and wisdom, but also that you would give us the wisdom to use that insight with great care and for your glory. We pray all this in your Son's name. Amen.